Hello everyone, you're very welcome to the first episode in this series of the Marie Keating Foundation Talks Cancer podcast. This series, we're talking prostate cancer. In this episode, Director of Nursing and Urology Care Coordinator Helen Forrestal and Liz McAvoy from Tala University Hospital are getting the series off to a strong start, exploring the facts, stats and background to prostate cancer in Ireland. Along with this insightful overview, they'll be answering some of the most frequently asked questions about prostate cancer. Like, what are the signs and symptoms? When do you go to your GP? Family history, and so much more.
Liz, it's great to have you here today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
It's great to be talking prostate cancer. You know, within the Marie Keating Foundation, we work with men and women, and we really want to emphasise prostate cancer during September, which is our Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, often known as Blue September. We know that after non-melanoma cancers, prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men in Ireland. Men up to the age of 75 have a 1 in 8 chance of developing prostate cancer, and men after that age have a 1 in 6 chance in their lifetime of developing prostate cancer. So it's something we really need to talk about and make men and everybody else more aware of. The average number of men in Ireland with prostate cancer at the moment is over 3,800, so it's almost 3,900. And unfortunately, men still die from prostate cancer, but thankfully, that is reducing over time. And one of the really important things I'd like to emphasise here today is that the 5-year survival from prostate cancer is actually up at 94%, and that's fantastic. And that's the National Cancer Evidence from 2021, so that's a really good start to what we're talking about today. So, Liz, we're talking prostate here. Can you tell me just maybe simply what the prostate gland is?
The prostate gland is a small gland that is found only in males. And in younger males, it's about the size of a walnut. But as you get older, it can become bigger and it can press in on the waterworks. Just because it's getting bigger does not mean that it's cancerous. But there is a tube that passes through the prostate, which helps with the passage of semen. There are two sides to the prostate. The prostate can be felt through the back passage. So this is why the doctor will probably ask to do a rectal exam. And that's actually to feel the prostate for any lumps or bumps.
So, thanks for telling us about the prostate gland, Liz. It's always good to know, you know, what it actually is and where it is. But there are certain risk factors, aren't they, associated with developing prostate cancer? I know that one of them is age, and most men over 50 would maybe need to be thinking about their prostate cancer health and possible risks. What are the other factors, Liz?
Well, the other factors would include, say, for example, family history. If your father or your brother has been diagnosed with prostate cancer in the past, that would be characterised as a first degree relative. Okay. You're twice as likely as the normal population to get prostate cancer. It doesn't mean you're going to get it, but you're twice as at risk as the general population.
Okay.
Another, that brings you on, say, to family history. And you'd have to say, kind of, it, you know, there is an inherited gene that can be in families as well. It's called the BRCA gene. And there's BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. Those men with BRCA2 genes are more susceptible to a prostate cancer, or certainly getting it at a younger age and a more aggressive type of prostate cancer.
What about race? Does that come into play here, Liz?
Yes, we do know that black men are more at risk of getting prostate cancer than Caucasian men.
Okay. I know that, like, obesity and overweight is playing a factor in many cancers. Is this the case with prostate cancer too?
Yes, indeed it is. And we know that particularly men who carry more weight around their waist are more susceptible to getting prostate cancer. And again, diet, westernised diet with lack of fibre can also increase the risk of prostate cancer. So diet and lifestyle certainly have impact in your chances of developing prostate cancer.
Okay. I've heard, and I know that, the signs and symptoms of prostate cancer are varied, but the fact is there may be no symptoms at all. Is that true?
Yes, indeed it is, Helen. In fact, most men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer may not have any symptoms. However, if someone has symptoms, it may be the sign of having an enlarged prostate. And by symptoms, I mean going to the toilet more frequently, having to rush to the toilet, which is like a case of urgency, passing urine more frequently, and even at night time. Now, I just must stress as all also that sometimes if you pass more urine, you kind of have to look at your lifestyle as well. What fluids are you drinking? How much tea and coffee are you drinking? Because this can contribute to the amount of urine you're passing, obviously. If you have difficulty passing urine, or if there is a sense that you're not quite able to empty your bladder properly, yes, that can be, it can be more than likely it's a sign of benign prostate enlargement, but it should not be ignored, and you should seek attention for it. And perhaps go to your GP. Another sign which may happen is that you may get pain on passing urine, or you may have even blood in the semen. These may be signs of prostate cancer, but they also may be signs of an enlarged prostate.
Okay. And I just want to clarify there, Liz, you said benign. So that means non-cancerous, but a growing prostate. Is that correct?
It's a growing prostate.
Okay.
What happens is the prostate grows larger. It tends to press in on the waterworks. As I say to the men, it's a bit like having your foot on a hose pipe with the tap running.
Mm.
You're going a little and often, and it's strained.
Okay.
It's strained kind of voiding.
What about blood in the urine? Is that a possible sign?
It is a possible sign, and blood in the semen as well.
Okay.
May be a sign. However, blood in the semen may be a sign of another condition of the prostate, which is called prostatitis. But again, all these symptoms you should discuss with your GP.
And what about then, like, you know, we have a couple of gentlemen coming on to talk to us about their own prostate cancer journeys. One of the gentlemen has stage 4 prostate cancer. You know, if we're asking somebody to be vigilant and alert to the signs and symptoms of a prostate cancer that might have spread to other parts of the body, what would those signs or symptoms be?
Well, the signs of cancer that has spread to other parts of the body, prostate cancer, if it's going to spread, it usually spreads to the bone. Now, people who have advanced prostate cancer often have back pain. And it's more of, they would describe it actually as more of a stiffness in their back. And it's particularly bad, funny enough, when they're at rest, when they're in bed or lying down. So very often they would describe it as difficulty kind of moving. They would also may get pins and needles in their hands or feet. So these are symptoms that shouldn't be ignored. There may be blood in the urine or difficulty or unable to pass urine at all. So these can be signs of advanced prostate cancer.
Okay. So
pain, obviously, Helen.
Oh, yeah,
pain,
of course.
Yeah, a lot of pain as well.
So we're looking at some of the same signs and symptoms of maybe, a prostate, localised prostate cancer. But we're also looking at like pain and other elements that affect other parts of the body for advanced prostate cancer.
Indeed. Yes,
okay.
Indeed, Helen.
Right. So I'm going to just, maybe we'll just talk about, a gentleman turning up at the mobile unit or in the community, and he's asked all these questions and he realises that, oh, he has some of those symptoms. And we're now, as Marie Keating nurses, referring him to his GP. What actually happens when he gets to his GP?
Well, firstly, he would discuss his symptoms with the GP. The GP may decide or may say, for example, say we should do a blood test called a PSA test. And the PSA test, the PSA stands for prostate-specific antigen. But there should be discussion about this test beforehand, because there's pros and cons, believe it or not, of going down this road of investigation. One of the pros is if, say, for example, the prostate test is raised, it doesn't necessarily mean someone has cancer, but what they usually do, another PSA test 6 weeks later to see if it's at the same level, has it gone up or has it gone down?
Mm-hmm.
So again, there should be discussion with the gentleman himself, and he should make an informed decision as to about the whole process of getting the PSA done. Because you can have a high PSA and no prostate cancer, and you can have a low PSA and still have prostate cancer. So a high PSA is called, when it's high and there's no prostate cancer, that's called a false positive result. And when you have a low PSA and have a bit of prostate cancer, it's called a false negative result.
Okay.
So there needs to be a lot of, I suppose, education.
Yeah. And I think I remember years ago, you know, when we did PSA tests, we said, like, people need to make informed decisions. As you said, they need to know about the risks associated with having PSA. And they also need to consider the possibility of having a cancer diagnosis on that. Really important, because it's a life-changing event, as we know. It changes how people feel and think.
Indeed.
And that's really, really important to consider. Yeah.
The doctor may also, on the day as well, when you were talking about what the doctor, what the GP will do, he will also do, perhaps do a urinalysis. And a urinalysis is to check to make sure that you haven't got an infection. Because the PSA test, which stands for prostate-specific antigen, that can be raised if someone has an infection. For example, if someone has an enlarged prostate, it can be raised even if someone has sexual intercourse the day before, because the function of the prostate gland is to produce the fluid that's in the semen. So a lot of people wouldn't be aware of this. It also can be raised if there is inflammation of the prostate or a prostatitis.
So it's all about prostate health, really, isn't it? So it's being vigilant, going to your GP, getting, you know, having that discussion, PSA test. What else might the GP do then, Liz?
The GP will also do a rectal exam on the day. And we spoke about it earlier, how the prostate is, it's actually closer to the back, believe it or not, than it is to the front. So you, how you access or feel the prostate is through the back passage. Now, the doctor will probably take it about 30 seconds to do this test. A lot of people fear this test, but really it's just where the doctor inserts his finger into the back passage with a gloved hand, and there's gel on it to make it, lubricating gel to make it easier. And he will be looking for the size and shape of the prostate. Is there any nodules there? Because the, they're able to tell a lot from this finger test, whether it could be an enlarged prostate or if there was any nodules there, then there would be suspicion that there would be a prostate cancer.
Yeah. So we encourage all men not to be afraid.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, absolutely.
It's a bit like having the cervical screen really for women, isn't
it?
Yeah. Don't be afraid. Do the test, have the test, say yes to the test.
That's it indeed, Helen.
Okay. Now, I know that the National Cancer Control Programme have specific guidelines to actually help GPs, you know, to make decisions about where this person should go next. No, and that's whether they should go to see a urology specialist, or whether they would actually keep them under their own care. And I also know that there's lots of, I suppose, different aspects to these guidelines. And there are, you know, centres in Ireland that are designated centres for GPs to refer patients to. But I also know they're referred to other hospitals, like Talla Hospital, where you work yourself, Liz. And it's kind of divided into some of what we've already talked about. So, you know, specific areas where men who present with symptoms suspicious of advanced prostate cancer would definitely be referred via these guidelines to the urology department. Men between 50 and 70 years of age who have no symptoms, and we talked a little bit about that as well. Then, you know, I'm sure you probably see a lot of men, you know, between the ages of 50 and 70 with symptoms and without symptoms. And then we have men greater than 70 years of age. So I suppose from here on in now, Liz, we're going to talk a little bit about that gentleman turning up in your clinic. What happens next?
Well, firstly, the gentleman comes into the clinic. Usually they're asked to fill their bladder with water, and we perform a test called a flow test. And the flow test is to check to see if there's any blockages along the prostate. and it's able to tell us the rate and flow of urine. So that test tells us a lot. There are a few other tests we will also do on the day. After he has done the flow test, we will bring him into a room where we will have a bladder scan. Now, the bladder scan is to check to see has he left any water in the bladder after passing urine. And remember, I was saying to you, sometimes men get the feeling that they haven't really emptied their bladder properly. And a lot of the men would say that to me and they go, I think I'm imagining it. And I go, no, you're not imagining it at all. It may be that you're still holding on to water. And sometimes if men are holding on to water in their bladder, that might not necessarily be a sign of prostate cancer. It could be a sign that they've just got an enlarged prostate.
Mm-hmm.
Then on the day as well, I will also do a rectal exam, the digital rectal exam that we spoke about. I will make sure that they've had two PSAs done. And this is really important because even if the first PSA was raised with the GP, and we spoke about the GP, sometimes these results can just be spurious. So we will check to make sure that they've had a second PSA done. And if not, we'll do it on the day as well. The other thing we will do is we will do a symptom score. It's called an IPPS score, and we send that out with the invitation or the patient appointment. And there's 7 questions on it. And included in the questions are, say, for example, do you ever feel like you don't empty your bladder properly? Do you ever feel that the flow is slow? Do you ever have to go to the toilet within 2 hours? Are you up at nighttime, for example? And do you have to go to the toilet to pass water urgently? Again, when the men answer these questions, you can see sometimes they get a bit nervous and they kind of go, oh my God, I have so many symptoms. Mm. And again, it's all about talking to them, saying, look, we don't know what's happening yet. We're only this. All these tests are like little pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. We cannot get the complete picture until we have everything done.
Mm-hmm.
So, a lot of the men are very nervous because they would say things like, I've never been in hospital before. So again, it's about reassuring the patient and explaining each process along the way.
Yeah.
After I do the full assessment, I would take a list of medications as well. I would take past medical history if they've had any surgery in the past. And those are the kind of questions. We would also, very important, ask about lifestyle. Like, do you smoke or do you drink alcohol? And what kind of fluids do you drink? Tea and coffee, for example, can exacerbate someone's voiding pattern or how often you go to the toilet. So sometimes they might simply just have to make lifestyle changes.
Yeah. So caffeine, you're saying, is an irritant, really?
Absolutely. Yeah. And orange juice as well can be an irritant. And even green tea can be an irritant.
Okay.
Yeah. Gosh. Yeah. To the bladder.
Bit of learning there,
yeah,
isn't there?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I suppose, like, before we move on, Liz, I just want to come back to the PSA there for a minute, because I think maybe it's important for men to know, you know, the age-related PSA.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, would you be able to explain that to
us? Yes, PSA, there are normal ranges, but it's not a static one. It depends on your age group. Say, for example, I'll just take 50, for example, because it's the most common age, you know, over that age. If you're in your 50s, your PSA should be less than 3.
Okay.
If you're in your 60s, it should be less than 4. And in your 70s, it should be less than 5.
Okay. So that's fairly standard, is it, across the guidelines?
Yes, that's standard across the guidelines.
And it can deviate for non-cancerous prostate as well. It can be much higher, I guess.
It can be much higher, especially in infection. It can be very, very high in infection, which is very important then. If you see somebody as well in the clinic, what I would do, if someone's PSA is very high, I would also make sure that I did a urinalysis or sent the urine off to the lab to make sure there's not infection.
So now they've seen you, Liz, and you're doing a great job.
Thank you so much.
So you've done a PSA. You've probably done 2 PSA tests at this stage to note any change over time. You've done a urinalysis, so you've tested their urine, and you've done symptom scoring. Okay, so you're getting a better picture now of what's going on, you know, for this gentleman. What else do you do?
when I finish my assessment, the urologist usually looks over what I've done, and usually anybody who has two PSAs which are raised will have an MRI scan.
Okay.
So the consultant urologist will order an MRI scan. It's very important also, Helen, at this point, to explain that to a gentleman when he's in with me, to say to him, you know, I know that you will be sent for an MRI scan. And this is the point that patients often get panicked, and they would say, oh, do I really need an MRI scan? And, you know, a lot of them would not be expecting it.
Yeah.
At this stage of their journey, most people would expect it if they were diagnosed later. But the reason why we do it is just to make sure, just to get a picture of the prostate. So then if they need a biopsy, we can target the area that the consultant radiologist has earmarked as suspicious.
Okay. And you're so right, Liz, because, you know, like the trend has changed in terms of making diagnosis. I know it used to be TRUS biopsy, transrectal ultrasound biopsy first and then MRI. But now, as you say, it's mostly MRI first and then transrectal ultrasound guided biopsy. So now I guess we're at a point now where this gentleman needs a biopsy.
Well, you know, the patient comes back for, say, if he has his results of his MRI and he's told he needs a biopsy. Firstly, you explain the risks to a patient. This is really important to explain that there are risks to having a biopsy. The first risk really is because you have to go through the back passage to get to the prostate. A probe is inserted into the prostate. And in that probe, there is a little port for taking samples. So a needle biopsy actually goes through the rectum into the prostate. The back passage is never sterile, no matter what. It's never completely sterile. So there is a risk, and it's not through anybody's fault in the department. There is a risk when you take the needle biopsy that you can transfer some bacteria into the bloodstream, and that can cause infection and it can lead to sepsis. So this is really important. You also need to tell them about the risk that there will be bleeding for about 2 weeks in the urine, and there will be blood in the semen for up to 6 weeks.
Yeah, but you do give antibiotic therapy, don't you, to prevent a lot of this happening as much as you possibly can?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We do a risk assessment before the patient goes for the biopsy. The questions that we would ask, for example, is, have you had antibiotics in the last 6 months? If they've had a particular type of antibiotic that we would normally give pre-biopsy, we would change that antibiotic because they would have built up a little bit of a resistance. We would also ask them, had they had a biopsy before and had they had sepsis? We would also ask them, have they had blood thinners or have they had any prior infections, for example, that just wouldn't clear up? Are they on any medications that may alter their immune system, such as steroids? So some patients do need extra cover. And by extra cover, I mean they would probably need an IV antibiotic on the day or a drip antibiotic.
Okay. And that's reassuring to hear. So, you know, there may be risks attached to somebody having a transrectal ultrasound guided biopsy, but all precautions are taken to avoid those risks.
Absolutely.
So really important for people to know that, I think.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Indeed.
Okay. So we've had a biopsy, and actually I worked with a radiologist, you know, previously, and he used to always say that this is what it sounds like. And I thought that was really good for patients to actually have an audio of, because when they're lying down and biopsies are being taken, they hear what's happening, and there are several biopsies taken, isn't there?
There's usually now with the MRI before biopsy, sometimes they take a couple of samples from the target area. And the target area is the area that the consultant radiologist has identified as an area that may have prostate cancer. But they don't just take it from there, they also take it from the surrounding tissue. And as I said earlier on, the prostate has two sides, so they take it from both sides, even if they do suspect that it's on one side.
Okay.
Because there may be something microscopic going on.
Yeah. And I know prostate cancers, like the grading system is slightly different, isn't it, to other cancers? So there's a grading system for every cancer, but prostate cancer has this unique Gleason scoring. And I know when we talk grades of cancer, we talk about cell makeup. So the cell makeup is either low risk, medium risk, or high risk. Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about that, Liz, just so that we get some understanding of the grading and the Gleason scoring system for men?
Well, you know, cancer, as you're saying there, it can be divided into low risk, medium risk, or high risk. When they look at the cells under the microscope, they look at them and say, how different are these cells from normal prostate cells? When they're not so different, but still cancerous, they're given a tree score. Say, for example, if someone has all this cancer type, then they have a 3+3, and that's equal to 6. So that would be in the low cancer group. But say, for example, they look at them and they say, well, these cells are even more different, more advanced looking. They would might give them a score of a 4. So what they really look at, it's called, as I said, it's the Gleason grade. The cells that are predominant type are given the first number. So if the predominant type is 4, and they're mostly 4, it's called a 4. And then if there's some of the 3 score, they give it a score of 4+3, and that equals 7.
So it's a Gleason score of 7.
So they add the most predominant type to the lesser type.
Okay. And then a Gleason score of 7 is a moderate.
A moderate type.
Type of cancer. Okay.
Say, for example, then if someone had a cancer that the cells look completely different than normal cells, they might give them a score of 5. Mm-hmm. But if the patient had no other cell type, it would be a 5+5, which would be an advanced type, which would be a Gleason 10.
And that's a high risk.
That's a high cancer. Risk.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll just recap on that, Liz, that Gleason scoring system, because it's complex enough and we want people to understand it. So if we look at a Gleason score of 6, it's classified as a low risk cancer. Okay. Then if we look at a 7-8, it's classified as a moderate risk type of cancer. And then if we classified the Gleason score, sorry, if we had a Gleason score of 8-10, it's classified as a high risk type of cancer.
That's correct, Ellen. That's correct. Okay. However, I will say that, you know, I know it's very complicated, but when you have the gentleman will be given an information booklet. And this is really explained through diagrams in your booklet. And it'll make much more sense when you can see it visually.
Yeah.
So it is really important that patients are given not just verbal information, because that will be forgotten about. It's really important at this stage to give patients good quality written information.
Okay. And we have a great book on our website and available at mariekeating.ie on prostate cancer. So I would advise people, family members and men themselves, to actually locate that for themselves and have a good read on it. If they're in that space. Okay, so we've gone through an awful lot here, Liz, in terms of the stats around prostate cancer in Ireland, signs and symptoms or not, as the case may be, investigations that the GP will do, and then the whole referral system through the National Cancer Control Guidelines. We've looked at all the investigations that can be done within, you know, the urology department with yourselves and with the consultants. And we're coming like to a place and space now where we now know that our gentleman has prostate cancer. We know the Gleason scoring system. So we know the risk associated. We have MRI scan results. We may have bone scan results. And we're looking at, forming a treatment plan. Now, I know there are multidisciplinary teams within all the cancer centres and many, many hospitals in Ireland. Will you tell me a little bit about that process where you work in Tala yourself?
Well, in Tala, we have a urology cancer coordinator who's a nurse specialist, and she organises the multidisciplinary team meeting on all patients in the urology department who have been diagnosed with prostate cancer. I think it's a really reassuring process to know that your cancer is, or even for the men, for me to tell the man, your case will be discussed at a meeting with all, you know, you will have 6 urologists at it who will look at the whole picture and they will give a consensus. You will have a radiation consultant at it, and the radiation consultant is the specialist who would deliver radiation therapy if it was needed. You have a medical oncologist at it who would decide on the chemotherapy protocol if that was advised. More importantly, at the meeting, you have the consultant or the pathologist who has actually looked at your slides under the microscope, and they're actually discussed on the day, and your slides are actually looked at in great detail at this meeting. Also at it will be the nurses who will be involved in your care, and also involved in it will be the consultant radiologist who has looked at your MRI and has given his expert opinion as to where he thinks the prostate cancer is in your prostate. And it's really reassuring for men to know that, because a lot of men, when you tell them they have prostate cancer or if they're diagnosed with prostate cancer, a lot of people, funny enough, you know, want a second opinion. Mm-hmm. But when you tell them the level of discussion that goes on, it's really enlightening for them, but it's also really reassuring. And they will all say, oh my God, I never knew this went on in the background. Mm. You hear such stories, but this is super care.
Yeah, and I agree
with
you.
And it's the gold standard of treatment.
It absolutely is gold standard.
And
I think, you know, it's so reassuring for men and for their families, isn't it? That, like, the core teams, the specialists have talked and they've come up with a treatment plan. And I guess at that point, you take the treatment plan back to the patient and the person and discuss it in detail.
You discuss it in detail. And what can be really difficult for a patient is if they're presented with choices.
Mm-hmm.
This is the hardest thing.
Yeah.
And most people, most men and their families will just want you to say, what would you do? And I think this is where the role of the nurse specialist comes in. And this is where the information booklet comes in really handy, because the more informed patients are about each modality of treatment and the pros and cons of it and how it would affect their lifestyle, the easier it is then to make a decision.
Yeah.
So it's really important that written literature you talked about, that is really important that is given to the men and their families. Sometimes the men may not read it, but they will ask their wives to read it. And the wives sometimes will give them bits of information from it, you know. So they do it. It's very much like a partnership, even between the patient, the family, and the urology team.
Yeah, your healthcare professionals.
Yeah.
And like something you said there, Liz, and I told, you know, I've actually experienced it myself, you know, working as a prostate cancer nurse specialist. It's a family orientated, you know, it's a disease that affects not only the person who's been diagnosed with the cancer, but intimate relationships with their family, with their, you know, their own partners and families as well. So it's really important to consider that. So I think we're coming to an end here, Liz. And I think something else you said important there is, you know, sometimes men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer have choices. That is really difficult. And that's, I think, where, you know, we have to take time to talk to men with prostate cancer and their families, and for them to understand that. And I do really hope that this podcast will have helped in some way to make that process a little bit clearer, and maybe for them to understand a little bit more. But next week, we're going to talk in much greater detail about the treatment options that, you know, will have been discussed at the multidisciplinary team. And that will be, you mentioned the surgeons, the urologists, you mentioned the consultant radiotherapists, and medical oncologists are also quite a big part of the treatment plan. So we're going to have some interesting in-depth discussions with members of the core MDT next week. So Thank you very much, Liz. It was great chatting to you today.
Great chatting to you too, Helen. Thank you.
That's all for this episode. Thank you once again to our brilliant guest speaker for their insight, to our sponsors Janssen for their support in making this series possible, and to all of you for tuning in. Join us next time, where we'll once again be talking all about prostate cancer. In the meantime, you can visit mariekeating.ie for more on Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Tune in next time, but until then, have a great week.